Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is Jane Smiley, author of Perestroika in Paris, published earlier this month by Knopf. Jane is a prolific author of children's, YA, and adult works, including, as many of you know, the Pulitzer Prize-winning 1,000 Acres. Perestroika is her latest work, published just after, kind of, the completion of her The Last 100 Years trilogy, and lots of books about horses. Perestroika is the long name for Paris, P-A-R-A-S, out of Northern Dancer, by the way. Her journey is the main storyline of the book, but along the way, she picks up friends and acquaintances. Frida, an elegant German short-haired pointer. And Paris is a thoroughbred, by the way.
Absolutely, yes.
And of course, there is Raoul, an erudite raven who thinks quite a bit of himself. He worries a little bit about that, too. But Frida is a mumbler, so they each have their own villains. Then there are Sid and Nancy, two mallards aptly named, as we will discuss, and a 97-year-old lovely woman, Madame de Mornay, and her descendant and assistant of sorts, he's 8 years old, Etienne. Evelyn, Madame de Mornay, has had a tragic life, but lives on in acceptance and graciousness, even though there is a horse living in her house.
Well, she doesn't know that.
Yeah, because she's... The animals, they're oblivious to parts of human nature, but acutely keen of others, have adventures, and that's what this book is about, adventures that couldn't possibly happen. But as we read, we wonder, maybe this could happen. That's the best part of this book, which I read in one sitting, which was, I'm mad at her about because I finished at 4 o'clock in the morning and got okay. So welcome, Jane, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So I guess we should start our discussion by talking about talking animals. Where do they come from?
Well, I know from having a lot of horses and a lot of dogs that they have thoughts and they have feelings. I also know that they communicate with one another, not always verbally, but they do communicate with one another. And so it was an easy step to go from knowing that they're aware, that they communicate with one another, that they have thoughts and feelings, to giving those thoughts and feelings expression. It wasn't hard, and I enjoyed doing it, actually.
Well, let's talk about Paris first, obviously, because she's kind of our protagonist. And she's a lovely woman, her horse. So. So I guess
she's a filly. Excuse me, she's a filly, soon to be a mare. So yeah. When the book starts, she's still essentially a teenager.
Right, and she's looking forward to becoming a mare.
Yes, she is.
So, and since I brought it up, let's talk a little bit about lineage, and for those who don't know, who Northern Dancer really was.
Well, he was a racehorse who did a very good job, and then his progeny went on to win a lot of races. And so my horse, Perestroika, her sire was Moscow Ballet. Another Northern Dancer horse was a horse named Jajinski. So they made up those names to show that these horses were related to Northern Dancer. He was a very prolific sire. He was fast, and a lot of the horses that are his progeny were quite fast. But sire lines sort of come and go in the racing business, and the Northern Dancer line has been very steady in its ability to reproduce.
Yeah, he actually won the Kentucky Derby, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And he was maybe the only Canadian horse who won the Kentucky Derby as well.
I think that's true, yeah.
Yeah, so You know, I'm not going to give away spoilers, but you stop me if I get anywhere near. But
okay,
Paris takes a journey, obviously, to Paris. And it's funny because in the reviews, and I thought, Sue, it's kind of born of curiosity. And you must have thought a great deal about horses and curiosity. And are they curious creatures in your experience?
Well, some are, some aren't. My Paris actually is curious. I remember when she was quite young, we were in a riding arena, and she went over to the mounting block, and I thought she wanted me to get on her, but she didn't. She wanted to lift the lid of the mounting block and see what was in there. She couldn't, there was no food in there. She wasn't smelling anything delicious. And then after that, almost every time we went into that arena, she'd want to go over to that mounting block and check it again. And then subsequently, every time she saw a mounting block, she was hoping there was a lid that she could lift. She looks up into the woods. She looks around. She keeps her eye on things. I just think she's a curious horse. She's always snuffling my pockets, even if they don't have any treats in them. So, yes, she's curious.
I tend to jump around a lot, but that made me think of one thing. It was about Frida. When she's wondering about Paris, just like you're saying about the smell, she says to herself, it's really good I have such a good sense of smell. Otherwise, I'd be lost in this city. And, you know, she knows, okay, she's up this block and she turned here. And then I think she turned here and then I think she turned here. And I kept thinking, wow, that would be, because I have a horrible sense of direction. Wouldn't that be great if I could do that?
Well, there, I'm sure for a dog, there are a lot of things to smell in Paris. You know, there's restaurants, there's people, there's trash. And that's the way dogs, as according to my research, that's the way dogs orient themselves in a lot of strange places, like in the woods or whatever, because their sense of smell is much sharper than humans, and in some ways sharper than their sense of sight. So that was sort of a logical jump for me, but I just thought it would work.
Yeah, and it definitely did. And also it helped with Frida in the sense that she was kind of the helper animal, that mm-hmm. she helped with food, she helped with orientation, but mostly with food. And if you want to, you can tell the story of the purse first to get us set up.
Well, at the very beginning, when the groom unintentionally leaves the stall door unlocked and then goes off to the bathroom, and one of the first lines is, and Paris says, why not in the stall? She could never answer that question. Paris bumps her chest against the door of the stall, and horses often do that. And this time the stall door opens, and so she starts walking out into the twilight, and the groom has left her there's nobody else around, and they're just waiting for the trailer to come back, and the groom has left her handbag on the ground near the purse, along with a couple of other things. She's left her handbag on the ground near a couple of other things. Mm-hmm. And Paris notices it because she's seen humans, female humans, pull things out of handbags. And she knows it's called a purse. And she also knows that whatever she won in the previous race that she just won is also called a purse. So she figures that's it. That's her purse. She doesn't know the details about human words. She just knows what she hears. So she picks up the purse and she carries it with her into the woods. And after a pretty long walk through the woods, mostly because there's various bits of grass and she's curious, but there's also various bits of grass and stuff to eat. She comes to a plaza called the Place du Trocadero, and she's still carrying the purse. And by that time, it's very early morning. It's almost dawn. And she has the purse with her.
And the funny thing
she doesn't know what it's for. She just knows it. It's a belonging.
And Frida, who's had her master friend, long lost buddy Jacques and his guitar, she kind of knows that money means something. And so she says, she looks in the purse and sees what's there and sees what. And then she's so ingenious. And there's so many nice people in the book. And when I read about it, another person said this too about it. Isn't it nice to read something like this where everyone is in this world where we don't have that, I don't know, luxury, or that's not what's going on right now. But it was so nice to talk about, I'll let you talk about it, then you can say whether it's a spoiler or not and not do it. Talk about how Frida takes the purse and what she does with it and the nice man and all that, because that was fun too.
Well, Frida, I did look up the vision capacities of dogs, and I looked up the various colors of euros, and I saw that Frida would be able to distinguish between the euros that are in the purse. And because her owner, who has died, was a street musician, she knows that money comes and money goes. He had a kind of semi-successful but iffy life. He was a very independent guy. So she knows what money is for. She knows it's in the purse. And she has a little chat with Paris, and she realizes Paris has no idea. But then she thinks, okay, I could walk away with this purse. But she decides not to.
Yeah, and it's funny because there's a couple of things. One is that Frida, much like men and women who are attractive, and Frida's beautiful, she gets a lot of things because she's beautiful. All the people she meets go, oh, what a beautiful dog. And she knows how to move them along by giving them her paw or putting
them. Yes, she's a good trickster.
Yeah.
One of the other things she's learned to do in the winter is to play a part, to tremble and as if she's shivering, which means that people pity her and give more money.
She loves sausages. Yeah, that's the other thing about Paris that both Frida and Raoul, they don't really make fun of, is that she's so, her naivete, and Raoul especially, that she just doesn't know these things, where he knows pretty much everything, at least he thinks he does.
Well, he's a raven. For a raven, he's pretty old. So he would be like your uncle, your old uncle, who could never stop telling you stuff that he had learned over the years. And, you know, and you would roll your eyes and say, I wish he'd shut up. But sometimes you'd learn things from him, too.
Well, he spoke seven languages.
According to him.
Yeah. I think the funniest thing in the book, and I don't know why it's the funniest, is when he says, but he does say, I speak seven languages, but of course, all birds speak Chinese. And I'm thinking, you know, that kind of makes sense, but I can't tell you why it makes sense.
Well, I think it makes sense because that's the largest population of speakers in the world, so... If birds are going to learn human languages, they've got to learn the one that has the most, you know, speakers.
It also seemed to me like, it seems obvious, like, but it is Chinese that I'm listening to in the morning. The other thing that's quite clear, in addition to your love of horses, is that you must love the city of Paris.
I do. One of my favorite things to do is to just walk around.
Yeah.
It's very, because of the way it's set, the geography of the setting, the landscape is quite various. There's hills, there's flat areas, there's incredibly beautiful buildings, there's incredibly old buildings. It's wonderful to walk around in. There's nature, you know, there's parks, and there's, I don't know, it's... the last time I was there, which is now about 2 years ago, I was put in a hotel near the Bastille, which is on the east side. And I just walked all the way across to the Champ de Mars and the Square de Trocadéro. And I walked through the Botanic Garden. I walked through the Herb Garden. I just couldn't get over how fascinating it was.
It's funny because, in this room, I'm just writing down notes, with the Eiffel Tower, it reminded me, I read this book and I interviewed the woman who wrote it, called The Sun Collective, the guy who wrote it. And in it, the woman, she has a small stroke, but after her stroke, she can hear animals talking. So,
oh, really? Oh, I should look at that one.
Called The Sun Collective. It's doing very well. But in any event, so her husband is like really late getting home. So they're all waiting by the door and she's going, I wonder where he could be. I'm so worried. And the dog says, he'll be home soon. Don't worry. Don't worry. He'll be here. And she looks at the cat and the cat says, why do I care? And like when Paris looks at the Eiffel Tower and Raoul will say, what do you think of it? And she goes, why should I think anything? Because there's so many things that humans do that animals really would have no interest, especially cats would have no interest in.
I would say so, yeah.
Yeah, and you touch it. I think one of the interviewers asked you, where are the cats? And why didn't the cats fit into this?
Well, I don't know that you can have a cat and a rat as characters in the same book.
I didn't
want to put any of the animals in too much danger, and I feel that if there were cats, then that would be a threat to the rat, and the rat feels that too.
Yeah, and Paris doesn't want anything to do with eating a rat. You
know. No.
I like the way that Kurt, he's like, he needs a wife, and he needs to get out. He's a rat. He needs to find a woman really quick.
Yeah, he's young. He wants to reproduce. He lives alone with his father in this old house where they have lots of tunnels, but they don't have any companions. And he really is lonely. He's in some ways more lonely than the boy, the 8-year-old boy, probably because he hasn't learned to read.
I'm kind of like you because when I was a little kid, we had mice in the house. And I had this picture in my mind. I was about Etienne's age. And I thought the mice must have lived like in a little room inside the wall. Would come home from work and sit in the rocking chair with his pipe. Because it seemed logical for me that they lived there. So just like they have like a living room. And That was one of the things that was so nice about the book. And I think probably for a lot of people is it probably brought up things from their imagination that they hadn't thought about in years because it's all childlike. And even though this is not a kid's book or a young adult book, it does reawaken, I think, a lot of curiosity that some of us have given up on, the way people don't look up at the stars, you know, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. That's a compliment. Thank you.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, basically that's what life is just remembering to wonder, just remembering to think, what am I doing here? What is all this stuff? And you really bring that out.
Well, for me, the thing that it causes me to remember is when I was Etienne's age, that's what I wanted. I wanted a horse friend. I was an only child. My mother had, my mother remarried when I was 11, and now I have a brother and a sister. But at that point, I was an only child. My cousins were around from time to time, but not very often. And so I really wanted that horse friend. I thought that horse friend would be nicer to me than the girls in the neighborhood were sometimes.
Yeah, and going to what I was saying, Raoul, he pretty much pegs it when he says, you know, I've been watching humans a lot, and basically all they do is they kind of lay on their backs with their mouth. And then they walk around stuffing their faces. Christmas time, they drop most of it on the ground.
He's a critical sort of guy.
Yeah, well, he's kind of like a curmudgeon, and I've been well, there are some practicalities that you deal with fairly well, but you might as well tell us, how does a horse live in a house, even though it is a mansion? You know, just laying down and resting and getting up and walking outside to do his business, things like that.
Well, the boy helps the horse. There's the entry door that she there's several entry doors, and there's the one that she originally comes in. So there's only one step up in that one, and a horse could go up and down steps, as my horse Perestroika has gone up and down steps, especially if there's no rider on the horse. And then there's a back door, since it's a mansion, and there used to be big parties. There's a back door and a back courtyard where people would deliver the food for the parties when there were a lot of people living in the house. So that's the door that she goes out into the back courtyard to do her business. And the rooms are very large. They have a lot of windows. Etienne moves the furniture so that she can Paris can move around. And because it's an old mansion, the doors, the doorways are wide enough and tall enough for her to get through. So if it'd be different if it was, let's say a mission style house in California, I'm not quite sure she could. I'm not quite sure she could live in that kind of house, or in, let's say, Falling Water, that.
Oh, it's but yeah, and the other thing is, I was thinking at first, okay, the pooping and the peeing, and it's taken care of pretty well. But then I was thinking, why should I even question it? No one ever any book, you know? There's no characters that go to the bathroom in any book ever. And I assume the queen never goes to the bathroom.
I don't think she does, no.
The other funny thing was when Frida thinks no good can come of this whole arrangement. And that's when she becomes, when she needs her some Prozac, because she becomes despondent and she's just wandering through Paris. And then she still has a bill or two left. She gets a bag of stuff. But what she really wants to do, and it reminds me of my dog, is she wants to get a ball. And she dropped the heavy bag in order to show the doubt. A lot of these people are dour and sour until they see her, and she just makes them love her. But so then she gets her ball and all that. And then in your interview, I heard you talking about your dog and how he'll pick up rocks and just,
Oh, yeah.
and my dog does the same thing.
Really?
Yes, he loves, because he has to have something. When you come home, he grabs a towel or rag, has to bring
Huh.
it. Then
What kind of dog is he?
he's a golden doodle. He's running around right now. And he's like
Huh.
80 pounds, but he thinks he's a lap dog. And he's great. I love him. And he's named Putney. And all my life, all of my dogs have been named Putney. So he's
Oh.
fine, because I feel if I ever get Alzheimer's or dementia, at least I'll remember the name of my dog.
Well, that's a good idea. That's a good idea.
Maybe. I hope I have one left. Putney sticks. But anyway, yes, I just was in tune with that because he'll just pick up anything. He'll pick up a rock.
Well, when Frida has since passed, but and she was about almost she was 15 when she passed. But one of the things she loved to do was rip open dog toys and pull out the stuffing.
Yeah.
So she had a lot of eccentric habits. Our Labradoodle doesn't have those kind of habits. She's much more reserved in everything except tail wagging.
It is funny, and that's it's also a source of a lot of entertainment, amusement, and serious stuff in the book is that these animals that we take for granted, they do. They all have different personalities. I wonder how they develop, almost like is it a nature or nurture type of thing? And I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I as far as dogs, I don't know. but horses, it's both, because I've bred the horses and I've noticed that they shared a lot of characteristics. Not everything. They weren't like rubber stamp reproductions of one another. But the ones that I've had have all been alert. They've all been aware. And I read a theory that said that in a herd, some of the horses are sentinel horses. And it's their job in the herd to keep their eye on, you know, whatever mountain lion is heading their way. And then other horses, usually mares, are the boss horses. And their job is to keep the herd organized and disciplined. So I think that that horses for sure have nature and nurture. And you just hope that they're well trained, but that they also come from a good, easygoing bloodline.
Yeah, it's interesting. I read somewhere that the way you can tell the kind of person, what a kind of person is like, is how he treats his dog when no one's there.
Oh, really? Huh.
Which I think is very true.
Yeah, I think that's true too.
Well, so of these animals, obviously you have dogs, obviously you love horses. Do you have any experience with ravens?
No. But one of my favorite little items about famous novelists is that Charles Dickens did have a raven. He had a talking raven. And that always fascinated me. And so I would like to have a raven. I wouldn't know what to do with it or how to treat it, but you know, yeah. People have had talking ravens. I think it would be fun. Nor have I had a rat, but my stepdaughter, who went to an animal behavior school, one of her animals was a prairie dog, and she also had rats, and she said they were quite interesting and amusing and smart.
Yes.
So, I've never had a rat, but we've had rat in-laws.
Well, I had a rat, and her name was Ratina, and he lived in a drawer in the garage, and she had stuffed the drawer with bits of cotton and twigs. Oh. We had a lovely time, and we'd feed her. But then one day she was big, and we shouldn't have a big rat. So we got put her in the car, and we drove to a nice field and let her go there. And then The next day, when I opened the drawer in the garage, there she was.
How far did she come? How far did she have to come back?
At least 3 blocks.
Huh, that's funny.
I know.
Well, see, they're really smart. The animals are really smart, and they like things to be consistent too.
I like the way you're talking about Charles Dickens. I like the way that Raoul is somewhat put out of joint by the fact that people, of course, the Latin names I don't remember, but people just think parrots are so cool because they can talk. You know, see, I can talk as well. He just likes to, he is a little bit like me. and the other way he's like me is he does have this outside commentator that's saying, you know, maybe this is a little much. Back on this a little bit. And he does in one section, he says, I'm going to say this. And he says it in his mind and he goes, no, I'll just say this instead.
Well, we've all known people like that, so. I guess we've known, and you know, if you go outside, you can hear the birds shouting at one another. You know, they have something to say. They aren't just saying it as out of habit. So, I like birds. I'd like to know a bird, but I don't.
Well, it's true about that people and birds is because I have an independent bookstore where your book is sitting prominently on the front table, and. So I have a couple of customers that I just can't I start with them, it's 20 minutes of them, and they don't listen to a word I say. So, because of the person I am, I say to them, look, you have 2 minutes. If you can't say it in 2 minutes, so some of them are completely alienated by that, which is fine. And the other people I've trained.
Oh, that's good. That's really good.
It's not easy.
No, it takes time and effort, that's for sure. And you have to go slowly.
And it irritates me because my employees who I'm paying are sitting there talking to him about his experience with Henry Kissinger in China. I hope he's not listening. And he'll go on for at least half an hour about that.
Yeah.
At the front desk, and there's customers waiting, and I have to constantly, I call them on the phone and tell them it's an emergency so that they
That's a good idea. That's a good idea.
Oh, the other good excuse nowadays is if someone asks you to do something on a certain day, just say, no, I'm going to be in a Zoom call then. You can just say that anytime and everyone accepts it as an excuse.
Yeah, they do. Yeah.
Well, so going through the thread of the story, did you have, when you started this, was it full blown from your head, like Athena from Zeus, or did you just kind of like?
No, it's much more fun in my experience to come up with an idea and then follow it through and see what happens. That's the kind of books I like to write. The ones that unfold bit by bit as you follow the characters and you understand the characters. One of the great things that I enjoyed about the Last 100 Years trilogy was starting with babies, giving the babies personalities and characteristics, and then seeing as the babies grew up how their inherent characteristics would mesh with their families and with the world around them. And so that was similar to this. I prefer when things unfold.
So you're kind of watching the babies grow up as the reader is?
Yes, I was, yeah.
That's really cool. Yeah, so it's in one interview you talked about how this kind of book was kind of rolling around in your head, even when you were doing the trilogy, and you just, you kind of put it aside, but then it just kept coming back and coming back.
Yeah. That's what happened.
Yeah, so now, even though the book ends kind of, no, I'm not going to talk about that, but it almost seems like you could continue, not necessarily with this one, but you could continue. You have such a voice and voices for these creatures. And like I said, at first you think, nah, this is unbelievable. But as one interviewer said, no, it kind of makes sense.
Well, in order to continue, I would have to go to France and explore a lot in order to see where the next volume would take place. So we're just going to have to wait until I can get to France and wander around and wander around and wander around.
Well, hopefully we'll all be able to do that soon.
Yes.
Yeah, that sounds like fun. Maybe I'll go over just so I can get the lay of the land as well.
Yes.
But anyway, Jane, thanks so much for joining us today.
Sure.
And
thank you for having me.
And hopefully we'll be reading another volume sometime soon.
I hope so.
Okay. Talk to you soon.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.